the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. I've got a great one very timely for you today, as we're joined by Professor Mohammed Ayoub from the Michigan State University. His new book is called Will the Middle East Implode? And he joins this conversation as the President of the United States, Barack Obama, has launched new airstrikes into northern Iraq, and as the ceasefire between Hamas and Israel has expired and hostilities have been renewed near the Gaza Strip. He's got a lot of important points to make, and I hope you'll listen. I want to thank the people who make this podcast possible with their subscriptions. Paul L. Sesser is one of our longest supporters, and the first of every month, I know I can count on getting a check from Paul. Thank you, sir. And Doreen Marshall just renewed her annual subscription. Thanks, Doreen. I'd like you to join their ranks. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Under my picture on the homepage, you click that link that says sign up. Takes you to a page where you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. New annual subscribers in the U.S. of A. Get a copy of John Dist's rock and roll CD called Red Flag with our compliments. Today we talk about a book recently published called Will the Middle East Implode? And as if on cue, as we're speaking here on the 8th of August, there's quite a bit of renewed activity in the Middle East. Professor Mohammed Ayoub is our guest today. He is a distinguished professor emeritus of international relations from Michigan State University in East Lansing. And in addition to his latest book, he's published quite a bit, The Many Faces of Political Islam from 2007, and he also co-authored a book that was released in 2008 that focused on the Wahhabism, the Muslim sect that, of course, is prominent in Saudi Arabia. Professor Ayoub, thank you for joining me today.
Oh, you're most welcome.
As I referenced, just in the past 24 hours, the 72-hour ceasefire between Israel and Hamas has expired, and fighting has renewed there, at least the exchange of rockets from Hamas and some airstrikes by Israel. And in the last 24 hours, the President of the United States decided to both offer humanitarian assistance through airdrops to northern Iraq and has launched at least two bombing raids on the forces of the so-called Islamic State, the Sunni extremist group that has been expanding its turf in both Syria and Iraq. What is your comment on the president's decision, Professor?
Well, I think there was quite intense pressure on the United States, and particularly on President Obama, to do something or to be seen to do something in Iraq, in the Iraq-Syria front. Particularly that the Islamic State forces had now turned north and were threatening the Kurdish capital of Erbil, and also encircling minorities and putting them to flight and so on and so forth. So it's a decision, but a very hesitant decision, because as the president said himself, he doesn't really want to get involved in another war in Iraq. And he said that he had actually, one of the planks of his campaign was to pull the United States out of the fighting, out of the war in Iraq. So it's been a difficult decision, but it's a sign of the times. And I relate that to the fundamental issue. I think this is what people forget when they are talking about these superficial phenomena. The fundamental issue that a factor that has led to this proliferation of conflicts, including the emergence of actors like the Islamic State, is the unraveling of the Sykes-Picot boundaries, as they have been called, mm-hmm. that were imposed on the Arab East in particular, that produced states like Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Palestine, the Palestine Mandate, which then later most of it became Israel, and so on and so forth. These were boundaries that were imposed by the British and the French, primarily. The British at the end of the First World War, when the Ottoman Empire was defeated and collapsed, and the Ottoman territories, the Arab Ottoman territories were up for grabs. Now, I don't want to go into details of why, who took whom. Of course, the British took the lion's share, mm-hmm. particularly those areas that had energy resources. But what's important for what to understand what's happening today is that those boundaries have begun to unravel and have been unraveling quite dramatically. I mean, the Syrian Iraqi border is virtually non-existent now. I mean, even before that, the Kurds of northern Iraq had, for all practical purposes, established what they call an autonomous entity, but mm-hmm. for all practical purposes, an independent state.
And with the expansion of the territory controlled by IS, the partitioning of Iraq is well underway.
That is true, the partitioning of Iraq, but not only that. The IS doesn't believe that any of these borders should exist. Mm-hmm. So what they are aiming for is not so much the partition of Iraq, but the obliteration of particularly the boundary between Iraq and Syria, mm-hmm. because they operate on both sides of the border. And as these states have begun to fail, I mean, there was a phase early on in the 50s and the 60s when state boundaries were threatened by the rise of pan-Arabism and Nasserism and so on. But from the 70s until a few years ago, things had settled down in the sense that one had thought that these boundaries that had been imposed have now begun to look almost like natural boundaries, and that not merely regimes, but these boundaries had also consolidated. But with the emergence of the Arab Spring in particular, it became clear that these states were really very hollow, that they were colossus with feet of clay, basically. Mm-hmm. And that has now led to the emergence of the phenomena like the Islamic State. And it has also led, not just the Islamic State, but there are other actors, I mean, the Al-Qaeda branches and so on, in the area that have found safe haven in Iraq first and now in Syria. Elements that had been driven out of Afghanistan, though some of them are still present on the Afghanistan-Pakistan border, found that when, you know, they found it very fertile ground with the collapse of the existing states and you know, the state structures in the Arab world. So you have the obliteration of boundaries, you have safe havens for extremist radical organizations, and that has led to this, to what we see now, the mayhem all around, which to the outsiders appears to be totally unreasonable without any rational or logic. But if you go back into history, you can see where the logic and the rationale and the rationality of this whole phenomenon emerges.
And Professor, if we take the president's decisions and split them into two, I don't have a big problem with airlifting emergency supplies to the Yazidis and other non-Muslims who, for whatever reason, have placed themselves on this barren mountain in a cul-de-sac fashion. To escape the threat from the IS forces to convert or be obliterated. And I certainly understand that very immediate threat to them. My first reaction is, well, couldn't somebody else do this? Where is the Red Crescent? Where is Saudi Arabia, which appears to have the greatest connection to the ISIS fighters? And once again, for the U.S. to take a lead role in this inflamed part of the world where we have done a lot of damage in the last dozen years, just strikes me as repeating failed policies.
Well, but the problem is nobody has the capability. No one else has the capability or the will. And the United States at least has the capability, if not the will, to intervene in Iraq and Syria. So by default, in a way, the United States has been forced into this situation.
But again, you hinted, is
of its own making, because I forgot to mention this, that the unraveling of the Sykes-Picot boundaries was the American invasion of Iraq contributed in a large measure to the unraveling of those boundaries.
Indeed. But again, and I'm just brainstorming here. The complications are very clear. But Saudi Arabia's got planes that we've sold them. And they would be less likely to be the target of IS forces. My big concern, the second part of the president's decision to selectively bomb at least some gunneries that are attributed to IS, this is a very difficult proposition because, it's not easy to identify the locations or even individual fighters. They don't wear uniforms. They're driving former American vehicles in some cases, which might make it easier to take them out. But my point is that, by launching these airstrikes, and Americans always think we're invulnerable from the air, but all it takes is a well-placed surface-to-air missile to take out one of our assets, and then we will be in a position where there'll be a great appetite from the neocons for retaliation and to get us involved in a full-scale war in Iraq again.
Now, you're absolutely right, but have you ever come across a case in which the Saudis have actually fought for humanitarian reasons or otherwise? They like to buy the most sophisticated weaponry, but I don't know what they do with it. I don't think they're either capable, and they're not willing to get into this. And their relationship with the IS, if you go back to the 1990s, let's say, I'll come back to the IS in a moment, when the Saudis did have, even then, by the standards of the Persian Gulf and the Middle East, the most sophisticated stockpile of weapons, when Saddam Hussein invaded Iraq, what did they do? They ran to Washington for cover. And it was the United States that had to send in 500,000 troops in order to provide security to the Saudis.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the IS is concerned, while ideologically it borrows quite heavily from the Wahhabism that's practiced in Saudi Arabia, politically, it is the polar opposite of the Saudi ideology. It's a very radical force that actually, if you go back to Al-Qaeda, like Al-Qaeda,
mm-hmm.
it would like to see the Saudi monarchy overthrown as well. So I don't think the Saudis are in a position to influence the situation. Al-Qaeda, and since IS is an offshoot of Al-Qaeda, even though it has been disavowed by Al-Qaeda, by mm-hmm. the Al-Qaeda leadership, is a hybrid phenomenon. Its ideology is a combination of the Saudi Wahhabi social and cultural conservatism. But this is combined with a political radicalism, which comes out of the teachings of Sayyid Qutb, the ideologue of the Muslim, of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood in the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And this hybrid has created this hydra-headed monster, if you want to call it. On the one hand, it's socially and culturally very, very conservative. And on the other hand, politically, it's very radical. It wants to change the status quo. Mm-hmm. The last thing the Saudis are interested in is for the status quo to be changed in the Middle East, because it would have a terribly negative impact.
But isn't this Hydra that you describe aptly a product of the proxy war in Syria, where Saudi That's Arabia right. has been funding an array of the opponents of the Assad dictatorship with you know, this kind of blowback that is now being produced?
That's right, and I'm glad you raised that issue, because I've argued that one of the major reasons or factors that have contributed to the instability in the Middle East that we see today and the mayhem that we see today is the proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran, which is being fought in Syria, which is being fought in Iraq, which is being fought in Lebanon. The epicenter of all this, of course, is the Persian Gulf. And the Saudis have been involved in terms of money, in terms of resources, in aiding the elements that are opposed both to the Assad regime in Syria and to the al-Maliki government in Iraq, because they see both of these as being not merely friendly, but as proxy regimes or governments for Iran.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very interesting that that revolutionary Iran is interested or committed to the maintenance of the status quo in both Syria and in Iraq, while the usually status quoist Saudi Arabia is interested in overthrowing both those governments and regimes. And so this keeps this is being played out in the rest of the Arab world.
And Professor, let me build on that, because I'm sure this is not lost on the president and his national security team. But the other thing I'll mention is that the president had been trying to leverage any American support for the central government of Iraq on the departure of Maliki. And he's not willing to go. There's a completely dysfunctional parliament that's unable to form a government. And against
right.
that backdrop, the U.S. Involvement now puts us in a very uneasy position of being on the same side as the Assad dictatorship and the government of the Ayatollah in Tehran. And
that's right.
This, of course, further complicates.
This is just one of the ironies of what's going on in the Middle East,
mm-hmm.
That the United States and Iran are on the same side on some of these issues, except that there is an unwillingness in Washington to recognize that Iran and the United States have major overlapping interests, convergence of interests, and that they could build on this in order to improve relations with Iran, rather than constantly putting Iran in the dock for its nuclear policies.
But that, of course, is driven by the extreme alliance between the U.S. and Israel, where Israel essentially often is dictating American foreign policy, or at least defining the parameters of it. And that further ties the hands of the president. Let me throw one other element out there that I heard some voices on CNN last night. These are military people saying that one of the real urgent needs is to provide new arms to the Kurds. The Kurds are now outgunned because the IS forces were able to pick up all these used American weapons and materiel vehicles when the Iraqi army melted in their faces. And so, of course, if the U.S. unilaterally upgrades the armaments of the Kurds, then Turkey goes ballistic, and we've got problems on that side. So this is a monster of many tentacles and many very complex and difficult dimensions.
Yeah, there's another irony. Turkey is now cozied up. To northern Iraq, to the Kurdish authorities in northern Iraq. They're very good friends. In fact, Turkey is the economic lifeline of Iraqi Kurdistan. And the Turks would like nothing better than the Islamic State forces to be driven out of Iraqi Kurdistan. So I think that there's actually, again, another overlap of interest between Turkey and the United States.
Mm-hmm.
A Turkish policy on the Kurdish issue has undergone tremendous change during the last 10 years.
Isn't it true? I do agree that there's been a change, but the Erdogan government is extremely concerned about a Kurdistan that could ripple over into southern Turkey.
That's true, but I think the Turkish government is also trying this time very seriously in addressing its own Kurdish issue. And on that, they have the support of the Iraqi Kurdish authorities as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they're working in tandem. I don't think that Ankara is any longer very afraid of a Kurdish entity really emerging in northern Iraq. They have come to terms with it,
mm-hmm.
and are reconciled to the fact that it will happen at some point, and whether they want it or not. So in order to be on the right side of history, they would rather be on good terms with the Iraqi Kurds.
And do you support U.S. arming of the Kurds?
I'm ambivalent on that. I mean, on the one hand, the Islamic State is such a danger to everyone around it. And I was, frankly, very surprised, and what you say made me rethink this, that the Islamic State had been able to get all this weaponry that the Iraqi army left, the American weaponry, and that's why they're doing so well in their battles against the Kurdish Peshmerga, because I was under the impression that the Kurdish Peshmerga is a very, very disciplined and trained and experienced fighting force, and that they would not merely be able to hold off the Islamic State, but take the battle into the Islamic State's territory.
Mm-hmm.
But as you say, that hasn't turned out. So maybe it is time. I mean, even the Turks may be inclined now to provide arms to the Peshmerga.
And you know, your laugh is not inappropriate, Professor. It is mind-bending to see the way this situation is challenging the status quo. It's really difficult for me to see a way that the U.S. can maneuver or manage or use proxies to really curb the expansionist nature of the Islamic State. And, of course, you know, we don't want to put ground forces or even get involved in any way in Syria. That's a very strong position for me. At the same time, the Maliki government is not cooperating, at least from the U.S. perspective, and Obama has very few real useful choices.
That's true, and this is one of the blowbacks of the invasion of Iraq.
Well, these are boxes. The U.S. is boxed in, and these boxes were created in Washington.
Some of them, or many of them, were.
Yeah.
Many of them were, and it was done without adequate forethought by, as you said, a group of people called the neocons who were allied with the Likud lobby in Israel, who for overlapping reasons,
mm-hmm.
Wanted Iraqi power, military power, to be decimated. That led to the collapse of the Iraqi state, a deliberate policy on the part of Paul Bremer to get rid of the Iraqi military, and
mm-hmm.
that led to the collapse of the Iraqi state, and that again provided the base for the al-Qaeda type of people to start in gathering in Iraq.
And let me ask you this, because I was a little surprised to hear a report on CNN. Jim Sciutto was the correspondent, and he declared that ISIS is essentially descendant of the Zarqawi activists or insurgents who mm-hmm. were active in Anbar province, 6 or 7 years ago. Is that accurate in your view?
I think so. I think they are, because Zarqawi was also on the extreme wing of al-Qaeda, and had he not been killed, he would have also probably been excommunicated by al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
And these are people with similar, if not identical, ideologies of the Islamic State. And they don't believe in the borders, in the border between Iraq and Syria. So it doesn't really matter whether they're mm-hmm. Iraqis or Syrians. But I think you're right. And I think the CNN analyst was right, that they are an offshoot or a descendant of the Zarqawi phenomenon in Iraq.
And there was also an assertion that there are as many as 100 Americans who are fighting with the Islamic State forces. I don't know that to be true, but that was what was reported. And from there, I felt it was a great leap to suggest that they are being trained to then come to the United States and conduct terrorist activities. Have you seen any evidence that supports that notion?
No, I haven't seen any evidence. I've seen similar reports, but those are, you know, there's no corroborating evidence. Mm-hmm. And like Al-Qaeda Central, I don't think the Islamic State is really focused on exporting its terrorism or its activities, if you want to use a neutral term, to Europe or the United States. I think they're much more focused on creating a state, an Islamic state or a caliphate, as they call it, within the Arab East, and first obliterating these boundaries. So they are more focused on what one would call the near enemy, whereas Al-Qaeda Central in the 90s and in the 2000s was much more focused on the far enemy, which was the United States. So I think that's another fundamental difference between the two.
We're talking with Professor Mohammed Ayoub. His new book is called Will the Middle East Implode? And Professor, I want to transition our conversation now from the situation in Iraq to the conflict between Israel and Hamas and the recent attacks on the Gaza Strip. And in doing so, I want to inject the term genocide, because the president, in his late-night remarks on Thursday, August 7th, stated that he was acting with this humanitarian supply effort to try to prevent a potential genocide of the Yazidis and others who have been dislodged by the expansion of IS. And yet, when the term is applied to Israel's assault on the Gaza Strip, where at least two-thirds of the estimated 1,800 who have been killed so far were innocent civilians, women, children in particular. And, of course, they are targeted because of their race and their ethnicity and, in some cases, their religious values. And I had a recent discussion with colleagues about whether genocide is appropriate to apply to Israel's assault on Gaza. So can I ask you your evaluation of the legitimacy of the term, first as it relates to this new conflict in northern Iraq, and then as it might apply to Gaza?
Well, I don't know whether one can call the assault on Gaza genocide, but what I would emphasizes that, as you did earlier, that the Palestinians in Gaza in particular, but the Palestinians in the West Bank as well, have undergone immense suffering and loss of life and loss of dignity over the last several decades. And this has never been fully factored into American policy. So the Israeli-Palestinian issue has always been kept in a separate box, to use the term that you had used. Mm-hmm. And as you very appropriately pointed out, American policy towards the Israel-Palestine issue is often, is often decided not in Washington but in West Jerusalem. So I think that's why there is a hesitation to come out and call a spade a spade as far as American policymakers are concerned. Though this time around, from what one read in the news reports, it seems that both the president and the State Department have come close to crossing the boundary in holding Israel responsible for the mass killings of innocent people.
And so, in your view, what is an appropriate set of factors that causes the term genocide to apply?
Well, genocide, like beauty, is in the eye of the beholder, basically. Mm-hmm. So it's a very politically loaded term.
It is, yeah.
If you don't like what's happening to some people and some ethnic groups, you call it genocide. On the other hand, atrocities of an equal level that are being committed against people that you don't particularly care for, or if you're on the side of the perpetrator, you don't use the word genocide.
Mm-hmm. In this discussion I had, I argue that it is tricky to label the current assault on Gaza as genocide, potential genocide, or attempted genocide. But the expressions of many Israeli leaders, I think, have genocidal aspirations. Here's Moshe Feiglin, Deputy Speaker of the Knesset and a top member of the Likud Party, who calls for concentration camps in Gaza, the conquest of the entire Gaza Strip, annihilation of not only all fighting forces but their supporters. And Andrew Sullivan has just published essentially a digest of some of the most extreme, and I would label them genocidal, commentary coming from Israeli leaders, referring to Palestinians as little snakes who need to be wiped out. And yet, you know, Israel plays the victim card so often, saying that Hamas will not repudiate statements that it wants to, and of course these are mistranslated commentary often, but that Hamas wants to wipe Israel off the map or wipe the Jewish state away from the lands between the river and the sea. And so, you know, I find it really difficult because we don't get objective commentary for the most part in the United States. And these very extreme statements coming from Israel are quite alarming. And we don't hear anyone saying, wait a minute, that's too far. That's going too far. The United States needs to reject that kind of thinking because it's behind the policies of this extreme Netanyahu government.
Yeah, you're very right. I saw that article by Andrew Sullivan that you referred to with all the quotes that are in there, and they're extremely frightening. But this is a product of the fact that that Israel is, as Maxime Rodenson, the French sociologist, termed it maybe about 50 years ago, a settler colonial state. It's sort of in its DNA. So what's happening, and you have to then portray an image of the native population as being in a way, you know, so in such a dehumanized fashion that you can expel them or kill them or whatever. And I think that's though not all Israeli leaders, not all segments of Israeli opinion subscribe to that. There is a strong element which is in fact getting stronger in Israel, that's very much taken up with that idea. Because even if you go back to the creation of the Israeli state in 1948, and there have been Israeli historians like Avi Shlaim, Benny Morris, Ilan Pappe, who have documented this quite copiously, that the state would never have become been established or at least not become viable had there not been mass expulsions and atrocities, one could call them that, against expulsions of and atrocities against the native population, the Palestinians who inhabited the land. And the settler phenomenon that you see now in the occupied territories is basically an extension of that Israeli instinct, one mm-hmm. would call that.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening in Gaza is the most extreme fashion of the same, or at least the dehumanization of the Gazan population is basically an extension of the same phenomenon. As far as Hamas is concerned, I mean, it's religious, political ideology apart. In 2006, when it won the presidential elections, and I've written about this, several of its leaders made explicit comments that they were willing to have a long-term truce with Israel if they came to power. The Hudna, to borrow it from the Arabic-Islamic lexicon, which I think they would have then used to prepare their constituency to come to terms with a two-state solution. Unfortunately, they were not allowed to come to power by Israel, by the United States, by the European Union, and this has further radicalized now the Hamas constituency, which until then I thought had been moving towards greater moderation.
And Professor, you know, I have a report here from the negotiations that continued overnight in Cairo. And I'll first comment that asking the Palestinians, and Hamas in particular, to approach these talks and consider Egypt to be a fair and, you know, unbiased mediator is a real stretch. However,
that's true.
The foreign ministry said that the negotiations so far had yielded agreement on the great majority of topics of interest to the Palestinians. Now, that's a little vague, but the Palestinian demands have been fairly straightforward, that they want an end to the blockade of Gaza, and they've asked for the release of a mere 100 prisoners, when we know that Israel has rounded up numbers far greater than that, to estimated 400 to 800, since the disappearance of the kidnapped teenagers in June. And so it appears that that Israel isn't negotiating very much. And once again, the Palestinians appear to be giving a great deal of ground. And yet, you know, we can't find any kind of a long-term solution here.
Yeah, I think this is it's of paramount importance to the Palestinians and to Hamas in particular to get the blockade lifted, because life in Gaza has become extremely intolerable. And I do not think that they would agree to a solution this time around, or to any form of a continuing long-term ceasefire or truce, until and unless that issue is addressed. Of course, the Hamas hand is enormous, has been enormously weakened in the last couple of years, with the overthrow of the Muslim Brotherhood, of the Morsi government in Egypt, mm-hmm. and its replacement by an extremely anti-Hamas military regime.
Yes.
As well as the fact that Hamas's other primary supporter, Syria, or the Assad regime in Syria, has now cut off links with Hamas, because the Hamas decided to support the opposition movement. Mm-hmm. Against Syria and against the Assad regime,
right.
And Iran, who has been a supporter of Hamas and has been sending, I'm sure, some arms to Hamas, has also its relations cooled off with Iran once their relations with the Assad regime cooled off.
Mm-hmm.
So Hamas has been playing a very weak hand, and this is why they agreed to this unity government,
right.
under Mahmoud Abbas, but the Israelis sabotaged that idea. The Israelis don't want a unity government.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want a single entity or a single Palestinian front that includes Hamas that would negotiate with them on a two-state solution.
And
frankly, to me, the two-state solution is dead.
I think
the supreme irony of this entire Israeli-Palestinian conflict going back the last 60, 65 years,
mm-hmm.
That the original Palestinian agenda of one state between the river and the sea has been and is being implemented with the force of Israeli arms.
Yeah, it's just not their state.
Well, it is not, but if you accept the logic that there's going to be only one state,
right.
then one can work on changing the nature of the state.
Mm-hmm. And Professor,
given the demographics.
Are you familiar with Max Blumenthal's book, Goliath?
Sorry, what is the title?
It's called Goliath.
Goliath. No, I'm not. I haven't.
Oh, well, let me recommend it to you. He's a young American in his 30s. He spent a couple of years in Israel and wrote a very powerful book just based on his observations during that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I interviewed him in early July, and he was the first to report that the Israelis knew within 24 hours that the three kidnapped teenagers had been killed. One of the kids made a cell phone call, and
that's right. I read that. I read reports about that.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And so Blumenthal is a very courageous young American Jew who is willing to really expose the extreme and some of the wrongdoing that occurs by the Israeli government. And he most recently wrote a post which was a refutation of the claims that Hamas uses people as human shields, and that they...
I think I saw that somewhere, yeah.
It was published at Alternet on August 6th.
Okay.
And, right. You know, he describes, for example, he says that the Zionists use the human shield slander, and it is a projection. He says Israel's the most militarized society on earth, with soldiers and military installations honeycombed throughout its civil society. And just as one example, in Tel Aviv, one of the most densely populated neighborhoods is where the army's headquarters, Ha Kiryah, is located. And so Israel claims that Hamas, which of course, you know, doesn't have a military parade ground or a military base where they keep their rockets, they don't have uniformed members. They have to operate in a guerrilla warfare style. Yet Israel tries to use that as a pretext for the rationalization of the killing of women and children.
That's true. And also, Gaza is such a small area that you can't really have those parade grounds and military installations that you can have in countries of reasonable size. But talking about Blumenthal's book reminds me, I recently finished reading, I don't know if you've seen the book, Miko Peletz.
Yes, I've interviewed Miko.
Oh, you have? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was going to recommend that to you if you haven't seen it. I found it a very moving account, his transformation mm-hmm. from a committed Zionist to a believer in a one-state solution. He's General Matty Peletz, Peletz's son, and therefore the book is called The General's Son. Mm-hmm. His conversion, in a way, from being a diehard Zionist into one who believes in a one-state solution with equal rights and privileges for all its citizens, regardless of race and religion.
And just since you mentioned him, if listeners want to find that interview, if you go to peterbcollins.com and enter Miko Peled, P-E-L-E-D, in the search window, you'll find that podcast and you can catch up with it. Professor, let me read a passage from your book, Will the Middle East Implode, that's germane here. You write, "It is a singular irony that Israel, which is by far the largest recipient of American largesse, has much greater clout in Washington than the United States has with Israeli policymakers." And you go on to explain your supporting rationale for that argument. But it is a really critical point that I alluded to earlier, that Israel really sets the contours or the parameters of American policy in so many ways, and our alliance with Israel undermines our credibility and our efforts to broker in certain situations. And yet, in this recent episode, which unfortunately is, you know, moving into its next chapter, America has just, you know, isolated itself with Israel from the rest of the world. And we have the Senate's, you know, a unanimous resolution in support of Israel's assault on Hamas. We have the gratuitous advance of $225 million to support the myth that the Iron Dome works 80% of the time. And after the president's mouthpiece issued sharp criticism of Israel for its attacks on these UN refuge facilities in Gaza, the president nonetheless released hundreds of millions of dollars of munition resupply to Israel so it can conduct more of these raids that the United States is sharply critical of. I mean, this cycle of violence that the U.S. is a party to is stunning.
That's very true. It defies understanding, really, as to why there isn't a more balanced policy that the United States adopts towards the Israeli-Palestinian issue when all these facets of the problem are very well known to policymakers. Because I've argued, other people have argued, that Israel, from the very beginning, but particularly after the end of the Cold War, has been a strategic liability as far as the United States is concerned, rather than a strategic asset. So the only explanation that one can live in a way comfortably with is the one that was provided by John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt in their book, The Israel Lobby,
yes,
which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Oh, yes.
And I don't know if you've interviewed either of them on that.
Yes.
But I think that's also, I mean, it does provide the explanation, because they... they say the moral arguments no longer support Israel. The strategic arguments no longer support Israel. So the only thing that is left is the lobby. And the fear of the lobby, more than the lobby itself. Mm-hmm. I think its influence is really overrated in Washington.
Yes.
But there is this myth that has been built that if you are found to be on the wrong side of the lobby, you're going to come out a cropper. Has taken hold so firmly that nobody dares to speak the truth.
Professor, in your book, you survey the results in many respects of the so-called Arab Spring. And it, of course, started in Tunisia, spread to Egypt. Libya is loosely included. There was an uprising in Bahrain, and I appreciate that you give it some focus. That often gets lost in the recounting of these events. And as you look back now, what do you see as the outcome of the Arab Spring and as these youth-driven movements did produce change? We've seen, for example, if we take Egypt as a point, where it's really come full circle back to what I consider to be Mubarak 2.0.
That's right. And let me just talk about Egypt just for a moment.
Sure.
Because I wrote a piece, and I wanted, want to bring it to your attention, and maybe to that of your listeners. The day after the Mubarak regime fell, I wrote a piece in Foreign Policy on the Middle East Channel, which was titled, "The Tyrant Is Dead, Long Live the Military."
Hmm.
And I had this is a play on the British. Announcement when a king dies, the king is dead, long live the king or long live the queen.
Yeah.
And I had argued in that article, it's a very short piece, that this wasn't a revolution. This was merely a change of faces. The military decided it wanted to get rid of Mubarak because he was no particular use to them any longer and consolidate their power. And there was this interregnum in which the Morsi episode took place, but the military really held all the cards or all the aces.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't really a revolution. In Tunisia, fortunately, I think Tunisia has been the only country where there has been a revolution and where the parties, once because the military is weak, it's not been playing a political role, and also because Tunisia doesn't have either a strategic importance or strategic resources. External powers are not involved that much. The experiment is moving, though one would be has to be cautious about coming to this conclusion, but it's moving towards a successful outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And the parties, the political parties, have acted very rationally and, you know, they've been able to negotiate with each other. And much of the credit for that also goes to An-Nahda, the Islamist party that came out with a plurality in the elections, that it has bent backwards to accommodate the other groups that have been in operation. So, I mean, I think the outcome, other than Indonesia, has been very, one would say, pessimistic or tragic in some ways. And one of the things that has happened is, and Syria is the prime example of that, is, as I go back to what I said earlier, is the unraveling of the state borders.
Mm-hmm.
Because several of these regimes, they really personified the state in a way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, once the regime collapsed, as it had happened in Iraq, then once the regime collapses, the state structure collapses. And it happened. The same thing happened in Syria. Once the regime began to unravel, state structures started to collapse. And what happens in those contexts is, then when, you know, the state, I always believe, is the supreme protection racket. It's the protection racket par excellence.
Mm-hmm.
And when it is unable to perform its primary role of providing security and protection to its people, because it no longer has the capacity to do so, then individuals and communities turn towards alternative sources of protection, be they tribes in Africa, be they sects in the Middle East, and so on and so forth. That gave rise to the sectarian conflicts,
mm-hmm.
because once the state in Iraq or in Syria couldn't provide you protection, then you turned to your sectarian hoodlums, in a way, or gangs, that provided you protection as long as you gave them loyalty and money. And that has led to the spread of sectarianism and sectarian conflict. And of course, before I finish on the sectarianism issue, I don't consider sectarianism to be an independent variable in this, in the unfolding drama in the Middle East. One of the reasons I've identified for the rise of sectarianism is the collapse of the state. The other reason is the Saudi-Iranian rivalry, in which both have used sectarianism, but the Saudis far more than the Iranians, have used sectarianism as a way to advance their interests and therefore have built up sectarian groups to undertake proxy wars on their behalf.
Professor, one of the reasons that I'm very wary of the renewed U.S. involvement in Iraq that just developed in the past day or so is that the same humanitarian hawks who are building very emotional stories about the plight of these displaced people who are displaced by ISIS, IS, whatever we want to call them, is the experience in Libya just a few years ago. And there, the casus belli was that Gaddafi was about to slaughter, I think the number was somewhere around 10,000 people in Benghazi. And therefore, we had to act quickly. And it was kind of remarkable to see these lumbering institutions like the UN take action as quickly as it did. At the same time, I found myself in the strange position of agreeing for one of the first times with Bob Gates, who was the holdover Republican Secretary of Defense in his final days in the Obama administration. And he argued that the U.S. had no national interest in Libya and that the expansion of our military footprint was a mistake, even though we were not described as the lead in the Libyan adventure. And as I look back now and see the condition of a failed state with these tribal militias duking it out on a daily basis, I really think it was a big mistake to take out Gaddafi. And I'd like to know your thoughts as you look back.
Yeah, I mean, Gaddafi was a very nasty person, and his regime was very brutal.
Sure.
But at least, like Saddam Hussein, it provided a degree of order to Libya, just as Saddam Hussein provided a degree of order to Iraq. So getting rid of Gaddafi, or before that of Saddam, without thinking through the consequences, was not the best policy.
Mm-hmm.
As far as Libya is concerned, well, in Iraq, the neocons dragged the administration into that war. In the case of Libya, it was the Europeans who had major economic interests in Libya that they felt were threatened.
Indeed.
By the unrest that dragged the United States into the Libyan war.
It was French
NATO,
oil supplies that were at stake, right?
Right, right.
I'm sorry.
And oil supplies and oil contracts.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing to see that NATO acted as the air force of the anti-Gaddafi opposition. And without that, I don't think the regime would have been overthrown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
And so the one other country that you touch on in your book that is always underreported on is Yemen. And again, I appreciate that your book, and let me just briefly say that it is a short book. It is a very interesting survey of the Middle East and in particular the so-called Arab Spring nations. And I think it's very accessible and I recommend it to my listeners. But Yemen is just written off as a kind of non-entity, a place where the U.S. can strike with missiles or fighters or drones at will. And we, propped up Saleh until we decided we couldn't prop him up anymore. And then
right.
We arranged for his replacement, but he's still in the picture. This is kind of a playground for American military and geopolitical games is the way I would describe it.
Yeah. Well, that's what happens when states are weak. And the state structure in Yemen has always been weak. And it's not really the United States. I think the major player in Yemen has been Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
And the Saudis and the Americans together have dictated many of the outcomes. the removal of Saleh and his replacement by his vice president. And of course, as you said very correctly, Saleh still continues to perform a role. But it's Yemen is sort of considered to be the backwaters of the Middle East, so not many people give it much thought. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, Bahrain has been consigned to the same place. I mean, Bahrain was a remarkable demonstration of people's power until the Saudis went in and crushed it.
Well, and the U.S., I thought it was a really telling moment about Obama's policies and the way he is constrained by Israel and, just by the many blowback potential situations that have been created by his predecessors. But Bahrain, I really feel for the protesters there. It's mm-hmm. it's a Shia majority with a Sunni monarchy that brutally repressed these aspirations for greater freedom. And because we've got a Navy base there that is critical to our interests in the Persian Gulf and a potential...
It's headquarters of the Fifth Fleet, yeah.
Yes, and a potential Israeli-driven conflict with Iran, then we had to subjugate the desires of the populace there and just, suck it up to support the autocratic rulers.
That's right, and at the behest of Saudi Arabia, too. But the initially, when the protests started, the demonstrations, the democracy movement started in Bahrain, it wasn't sectarian. There were both mm-hmm. Sunnis and Shias involved in it. It took on a sectarian character later when the regime decided to play its sectarian card. And as you said very very well, it's a brutal regime. The its security forces are primarily composed of outsiders, of Sunni Muslims from Pakistan and Jordan and so on, that have been lured in or brought in and given citizenship, who have no compunction in using extreme force against the local population. But for all the reasons that you mentioned, including the American strategic interest in the naval base, nobody now bothers about it.
Yeah. Well, Professor, it's a real pleasure to meet you and talk with you, and I thank you for your new book. And
you're most welcome.
I hope that people will find it. It is published by Polity. You can find their website at politybooks.com. We've been talking with Professor Mohammed Ayoub, and his new book is entitled, Will the Middle East Implode? Thank you, Professor.
Thank you very much.
Fascinating conversation with an expert on the region. I'd like to hear your comments. Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.